Hey everybody, welcome to this week's Q&R. I'm Megan. I'm so glad you're here. If you happen to have been seeing us for the past 30 seconds, we're like, are we on? 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 Sorry. But this is how we roll here at Q&R. But this week we are so excited because we have some new faces at the Q&R desk here. It's not a desk, it's a table, but anyway, we're acting like it's a desk. But you all got to hear from these folks this past Sunday. We have Beth Tapscott, who preached at Greenwood. She is a professor. And so we at Greenwood had the privilege of hearing Beth share about the church in every 500 years. And then we have Scott Newman, who's on staff here, who works in our youth, who works in our spiritual formation, disciple with Alpha. And so if you were at Melrose, you heard from Scott, and he shared about Jonah. And then we have Pastor Wayne.
You needed one adult.
Somebody to maybe keep us in line. I don't know if that's actually...
We couldn't find an adult, so I...
Yes, but we are so glad that you all are here, and I'm so glad that you all are here, that we were able to get Beth here so she could come and share with us today. And so what I think we're going to do, how we're going to start off, is if they can just maybe give a brief synopsis of what they talked about, since we heard two different things at each of the campuses. And so, ladies first. Beth, would you like to share with us a little bit?
Sure. So, I spoke about how every 500 years, almost like clockwork, the people of God lose their focus, that they lose their direction. They get too caught up in worldly affairs, they get too distracted by petty squabbles to actually do what they've been called by God to do, to love God with all their heart, their soul, and their minds, and to love their neighbors as themselves. And so we spoke a bit about this pattern and how every 500 years we go off the rails, but there's always someone who brings us back. And we stay on track for a while, and that, you know, we're sitting at the 500-year mark, and so the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, which was the last time we went off the rails, was back in October. We're sitting at 500 again. What's our crisis going to be this time?
It was really good.
I want to go back and listen to that, actually. Like, you've got me hooked.
Yes, if you want to hear.
How can we do that, Meg?
Yes, this is a perfect segue.
It wasn't planned, but.
Yes, if you want to hear Beth's sermon, you can go to the website, and both sermons from Sunday, every week on the website, you can go back and you can listen to who all preached. Typically, you'll get a Pastor Wayne and a Pastor Adam this week. You'll get a Scott and a Beth. And you'll get two different topics. If you are visual, if you like to see, like I do, I struggle just listening to things. Scott was on this Facebook, and he's on video on the website. But Beth Greenwood has their own Facebook page, Broadway UMC, I think it's been slash Greenwood Campus. And so Beth was actually Facebook Live during hers at 10:30. So you can go back to Greenwood's page and see her. You can go to stay on this page or the website and see Scott, or the website and hear them both. So I hope that cleared it up for you. But yes, so Beth did a fantastic job. And we'll come back because I'm going to ask more questions about that later. But Scott, why don't you tell us a little bit about Jonah?
Well, listen, what's cool, we were talking earlier about, like, do we try to tie these together somehow or just go, but they do, because listen, that what you just said about the church losing its focus and forgetting their calling, like losing sight of their calling, is what Jonah is about. Like that is the prophetic challenge in the book of Jonah, is that Jonah forgets, right? I mean, that was kind of, as I recap the story itself, we see that Jonah runs from God and yet God pursues him. We see that Jonah worships when God saves him with this fish. We see Jonah finally obey, and we see that God forgives. He gives Jonah a second chance, and he gives the Ninevites a second chance. But then we see Jonah forget. We see Jonah have this little temper tantrum and get angry at God's forgiveness and mercy. But we see in all that God is a God who loves. He still loves Jonah in that moment. He loves the Ninevites, despite how far they've gone away. But it's a challenge to Israel in that moment, because their calling was always meant to be about more than just themselves. Like, yes, they were the people of God. Like, God had chosen them and entered into this very unique and special relationship with them, this covenant with them. But it was never meant to stop with them. It was always meant to be for the world, for the nations, that somehow through them, God would use them to reach everyone else. And Jonah forgets that in this story. Like, he eventually goes and he proclaims the message of God, but when they receive it and God has mercy on them, he can't handle it. And it was a challenge to Israel of like, this is you. This is, you're forgetting what your calling is. You're forgetting your purpose, why I called you. So I think that is the challenge in the book of Jonah that still speaks to us. And that's exactly what you're talking about. That's really cool.
Yeah,
so
it's cool.
And another big part of that also, you know, even with the story of the church going out, the people of God going off the rails every 500 years, that's the one of the big lessons. But the other big lesson is that through it all, God is faithful.
Mm-hmm.
And that God is faithful and
yeah.
He is willing to use those people to accomplish His
mm-hmm.
goal despite their shortcomings, despite them losing the plot,
mm-hmm.
just like with Jonah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, He's still going to use them
yeah.
and achieve His purpose.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I love that. That's really great.
One thing Beth did, she had like really good, what's the word? The basketball, the analogy. There's an analogy, yes, an illustration that you can hear or see if you go watch it, but I'm not going to ask about that because it was real good. I want you to go hear all of it. But what I do want to say is like, I'm not a history person, just so y'all know.
You don't believe in history.
I do believe in it, I just struggle with it. Everybody's got something, and me and history, we don't get along very well. But I was very intrigued in your sermon on Sunday and how you talked about these every 500 years. So for folks that are watching that are like, well, what does she mean, like every 500 years we go off the rails? So could you tell us, like, you know, like, well, you don't, you can sort of
recap
the crises and
mm-hmm.
maybe how we came out of it, you know?
So, we can look at as a historian, we look for these big trends, right?
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the things that the past can tell us? Mark Twain said history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And I think that that's like the big thing here,
good.
Right? Isn't that great?
Yeah,
so within 500 years of the resurrection of Christ, the church goes from being illegal to being the only accepted religion
mm-hmm.
in the empire,
mm-hmm.
right? For the first 300 years of its existence, it's illegal. But then in 313, it's made one of the legal religions in the empire. And by 380, it's the only legal religion in the empire. From 313 onwards, the church comes to depend on the state for its
mm-hmm.
developing its theology. It's the church, it's the state that calls the seven ecumenical councils that
mm-hmm.
hammer out what we believe to this day about
mm-hmm.
the Trinity, about who Jesus is, fully God, fully human at the same time, and what
yeah.
exactly that means for salvation. And so they've come to depend on the state, because it's the emperor who calls it and presides over it. So they come to depend on the state for that, their formation of the theology. They come to depend on the state for promoting their agenda. I mean, it becomes in 380 the only legal religion.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're the only legal religion, I mean, that's
yeah.
pretty good for you, right, in your agenda. But
mm-hmm.
it comes at a price, and the church gets all caught up in the political affairs of the empire as well, and they start to lose the plot, and it becomes a political pawn. And when it matters most, the state abandons the church.
Mm-hmm.
From 410 until 455, there's a series of attacks on the Western Roman Empire by the barbarians. By this point, the emperor's ditched the West, and he's living over in Constantinople, and he leaves it to
God.
His
God will get it.
Yeah, there you go.
Say it again. You know,
Istanbul, not Constantinople.
Yes.
If you're picking up a date in Istanbul, in Constantinople, should be waiting in Istanbul. They might be giants.
Yeah, yes, I was saying, yeah, and the Animaniacs.
Exactly.
Istanbul,
so,
not Constantinople. Yes.
He's hanging out in Constantinople, which is now, the emperor is hanging out in Constantinople, which is now Istanbul. There you go.
See why we needed an adult here. I'm just
not doing my job.
We're not sin. Okay.
Bring it in, guys.
Yes.
Bring it in.
It's okay.
There we go.
So the emperor leaves the church to defend itself and the
mm-hmm.
entire Western
mm-hmm.
Empire. And the church is faced with a crisis, because in 476 it all collapses. And they are faced with the choice of defending themselves and coming out fighting and on the defensive, or to actually do what Jesus told them to do, which is love their neighbors. Mm. And so what do? They opt to go the route of Jesus, and they reach out to these barbarian tribes, and instead of sending soldiers, they send missionaries. And it changes everything. Over the course of the next 100 or so years, those barbarian tribes will become some of the biggest defenders of Christianity in world history, and are responsible for taking that message, for better or for worse, in the ways that they do it, to other parts of the world. They become the British, the French, and the Germans, you know? And, you know, they made that choice. But again, you know, so they get back on track, but they lose the plot again. And 500 years later, as all of these tribes develop into, and by the 1000s, all these tribes are developing into kingdoms, and those, they might be brothers in Christ at this point, but if you have siblings, you know that siblings don't get along, and so they're so caught up in fighting with each other that they lose Jesus again, so badly that it results in one of the first great divorces of the church, the split between the Eastern Orthodox and, or where you're sitting, Eastern Orthodox, and the Roman Catholic Western Church in the West. Yeah. They're still not on speaking terms, right? And then also it leads to the Crusades, where they start to go out and try to convert people at sword point. You know, it's a series of holy wars, or I would like to refer to them as unholy wars, against Muslims, Jewish communities, and all sorts of other groups of people. You know, not exactly our finest moment, right? But there are those who speak up and say, this is not legit. We need to stop with this. A couple of popes start to rein things in a bit with the church, clean it up a bit. Francis of Assisi is inspired by this and starts to cry out, let's get back to Jesus. Yeah. And he picks up that mantle that Jesus has given to pick up your cross and follow him, to live simply, to serve the poor, to love your neighbor, and to love God. Right? So we get back on track again. And then, but, you know, old habits die hard, because, you know, we're human and we make these mistakes again and again and again. And 500 years later, we're sitting in 1517. And the church in the West, the late medieval church, is a business. The leaders are more like CEOs than shepherds. And they're, you know, basically selling the church. They're selling the gospel, and you have to pay for it, you know. And there's so much corruption. One of these Renaissance popes, even the modern papacy admits that these guys were bad news. One of them, famously, Leo X, said, God has given us the papacy and we shall enjoy it. You know, dude's famous for having some of the most raucous parties that would make a frat party look tame. And marrying off all of his children, to some of the most powerful families in Europe. So, you know, that's not exactly good. But again, people step up and say, wait, we've got to get back on track. And so, you know, enter Martin Luther and the Protestant reformers, who step in and say that there's a better way to do this. Let's get back to the basics of the Bible. And so they start to strip back to, if it isn't in scripture, it's not doctrine. But they can't agree on what that means. So simultaneously, you've got Luther and Zwingli, who are both saying the same thing, but have different views of what it should look like. And then it just snowballs from there. Calvinists, Anabaptists, Anglicans, Presbyterians, Episcopalians. It just spirals off.
Once they started protesting, they couldn't stop.
Exactly. Protestant. I didn't know that. I learned it. I was like, oh, it was so good.
Light bulbs.
That's why, as we talk about at the end of Alpha, well, I don't want to give it away, but we always ask people how many denominations they think there are in existence. Laura always asks that, and the answer is many, many more than you would think.
3,400 registered Protestant denominations as of 3 years ago, and it keeps growing. That was part of the sermon. But it's that thing, right? It's just it creates the conditions for the second major split, and it's between the Catholics and the Protestants, and then the Protestants just keep splitting off. They still are splitting off. And those early years in particular ushered in 100 years of religious warfare in Christendom. Wow. We were killing each other because of whether you sat or you stood or you kneeled to pray. You know, it's like whether you have stained glass windows or nothing in your church. They're killing each other. Catholics killing Protestants, Protestants killing Catholics, Protestants killing Protestants. The only thing the Catholics and the Protestants could agree on is the only thing the Catholics and the Lutherans could agree on is the only good Anabaptist was a dead one. They like to tie millstones around their necks and chuck them in the river.
Don't still argue about things anymore.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I can't imagine. Right. That's right. You know.
What kind of crassness can come out of your vision, you know?
Wow.
100 years. So, yeah. But anyway, the dust settles and they got back on track for a bit. But here we are. We're sitting at the 500th anniversary of the Reformation was in October. Yeah. And, you know, what kind of crisis are we going to face? Yeah. You know, what kind of crisis are we facing? Because there are those who argue we're in it. We're in it already.
Right.
So.
And you did a really good job talking about Scott talked about too, that God's faithfulness to find somebody to use, that he does not give up on the story or on his people and what he intended from the beginning. So and even though Jonah ran, God still...
I agree. I think you nailed it. That that's at the heart of Jonah. It's like even when we forget, God is still faithful.
Right.
And he loves us. He pursues us. He sticks with us. That he is the one that remains faithful to this covenant and to this promise that he has made. In fact, in this, again, Jonah's four chapters and laid out, again, very distinct parts to the story. And so at the end of the second chapter, in this sort of psalm that Jonah is praying from the belly of the fish, right? Like the last couple verses of it essentially say that those who worship vain idols, or again in the Hebrew words, it's like vanity of vanities. It's like things that just don't matter. Like they who try to hold on to everything that just doesn't matter will forsake their faithfulness or loving kindness or their mercy or their grace that could be theirs or their true loyalty. It's translated in so many different ways, but the word is chesed. And so it's essentially the best translation I have found for it is like their covenant love. It's the commitment and faithfulness to the covenant, which is incredibly poignant that Jonah says this. It's like those who are trying to hold on to all these things that don't matter forget their commitment to the covenant, not only theirs but God's.
Mm-hmm.
And so the book ends with this reminder that even when we forget that part of this covenant is not just for God to be our God and for us to be his people, but it's to be a blessing to the nations, that all peoples of the world, like that is part of this covenant. And so even when we forget, God is still faithful. He is the one with chesed. He is the one with covenant love and commitment and mercy. And he shows that at the end of this story to Jonah and to the Ninevites. He forgives the Ninevites, which is unexpected, but maybe not. I mean, we see that in scripture. But it's also even in how sort of, it's almost like a gentle, like, mother with a child that is just, again, sort of stomping off into the corner, throwing a fit. And God allows this plant to grow up to shade Jonah, and then allows this worm to chew it and eat it. And it's like he's trying to teach Jonah a lesson. And so Jonah gets mad, and he's like, I'm so angry right now, I wish I were dead. And God's just like, do you really have a right to be angry about this? And he's, yes, I do. Like, so angry enough to die. And God just, again, he doesn't scold him. He doesn't, like, rebuke. He just says, okay, you care about this plant, which you did nothing for. You did intend, it grew up overnight. It died overnight. How much more should I care about this whole city of people? Like, and it just leaves it, just sort of mic drop him. And the story just ends, and it leaves that question for us to wrestle with of like, wow, yeah, like how many worthless things do we get caught up in caring about, and we lose sight of this covenant love, this faithfulness that God is calling to, that he shows to us, and he is calling us to as well. So
it just sort of like, you're talking about that bit about Jonah singing the hymn to God in the belly of the whale. All my mind, because I'm a Reformation historian, so that's where my brain goes, is Martin Luther in the midst of that crisis writing, "A mighty fortress is our God, a bulwark never failing, our helper here amid the flood of mortal ills prevailing."
Yeah.
Right? And that, and that whole song also goes back to the truth of the gospel and the promises that God has made that he will get us through whatever, and that he is faithful despite our failings.
Yes.
You know, it's the exact same, you know, the story continues. It just keeps going, right? So, and we're a part of it.
Yeah.
Love
It's God's story that we are part of.
Right.
That we're invited to enter into, which is kind of what the series is about.
Yeah, and it's when we put ourselves, I made this point, that it's when we put ourselves at the center of the story. We start thinking this story revolves around us, and it's like, that's when we lose sight. Like, it's not, this is not our story.
Right.
Yes.
And we kind of make ourselves the main character, and it's like, no, this is God's story, and we are a part of it, but God is calling other people to be a part of this too, and we lose focus.
We think it's about the things that matter to us.
That's right.
Instead of the things that matter to God, like you talked about, was the two things that matter, was love God and love your neighbor.
Yeah.
We forget that.
Yeah.
That gets us in trouble. Yeah. And then we end up killing each other over things that don't matter.
That don't matter.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or not going and telling them in the first place.
Right.
Right.
Because we don't want to tell our neighbor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I love how with Jonah, I mean, again, you get this sense of, well, maybe Jonah's just scared to go, which rightfully could have been part of it, because it's like, these are enemies. These are people that are not, they're not friends. They're not allies.
Right.
And he's like, go to your enemies and tell them the message that gives to you. But then later, in the middle of Jonah's temper tantrum, we were sort of given a clue as to why he didn't want to go all along. He's like, because I knew that you were going to do this. I knew that you were merciful, like abounding in love, like quick, you know, quick to forgive, and I knew you would do this, and so what you see is kind of at the heart of that is Jonah is also concerned about his reputation as a prophet, that he's going to go prophesy 40 days and Nineveh will be overturned, like, and then it doesn't happen, so it looks like he's now a false prophet, so like his sort of name and reputation is at stake here because God is merciful, like I knew this would happen. You say so again. It's like it's all about him in that moment. It's hot, and I'm upset. You know, everything is still even though he got it. Like he has this moment in the fish, where he worships God. I think very truthfully and sincerely. And yet, how quickly after that does he sort of go right back? Yeah. Which man, that challenges me because we're just so back and forth like that. We remember and then we forget, and we remember and we forget.
Yes,
and that's why we need constant reminding, right?
Sometimes quicker than 500
years.
Oh yeah, 500 years. It happens a whole lot more often than 500 years. 500 years just happens to be like major milestones, like big, undeniable milestones.
Right.
But it happens throughout. I mean, it doesn't happen overnight. It takes time to get to those points where you've reached the point of crisis.
Yeah.
And I think that it is the story, our story as humanity and the children of God, is that we are constantly losing track. I mean, Jesus' disciples, while he's sitting in front of them, we're losing the plot all the time.
Right. Yeah.
And that need to be brought back to it. And, you know, that we serve a God of surprises.
Yeah.
That he's going to do what we don't want, like, don't expect him to do, or what we don't want him to do.
Sometimes,
You know, like with Jonah and the Ninevites. But it's, you know, or even some of these folks that, you know, from our own family history of the history of the people of God who, you know, don't want... If I really reach out to these people in the Middle East with love, that makes them my brother. Do I really want that?
Yeah. We're a whole lot better at dividing and splitting and drawing lines than we are at uniting and reaching out and recognizing that oneness to love our neighbor.
Yeah.
And who is my neighbor?
Right, that our neighbors.
But I love that God, he meets us in those moments. Wherever we are, right? And he calls us forward. He's like, we can do better, right? And so,
kind of dares us to believe that he can love our enemies, and we can too.
Yeah, it's good.
Not just appear, but we can practice. You know, that's the thing. Can we practice that? Can we go to Nineveh? Can we somehow find unity in the midst of our disagreements?
And love them for who they are.
Right.
Not just because of what we want them to become or what we hope they will become, but who they are in that moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not love them so that they'll become like us.
Yeah, exactly.
But love them where they are and who they are.
Yeah. Right. Because that's what we're supposed to do.
Right.
That's good.
Even when it's hard.
I believe that's
especially
preach.
When it's hard.
Mm-hmm. I think it was preached.
I believe it was too. I believe it was too. So, yes, do you all have anything else you want to share? Like, we call this sometimes like the cutting room floor because you know they can only preach for so long. And so some things get left out that they would really like for you to know. So just sort of like anything that you want to, it's like, oh, I really wanted to work this in, but I couldn't. Wayne, why do you make that face for?
Well, it's usually about 20 minutes is all I can get this place.
You don't preach for 20 minutes.
Well, I'll just maybe say, I mean, I feel like, because we wrestle with tough questions here at this time, and so I intentionally, and anyone who happens to have heard my sermon or goes back and listens to it, you may notice that I spent very, very little time, like almost no time even talking about the whale. I can't do air quotes right now because I think, right, because I mean that's sort of how we know the story, Jonah and the whale. Even though the word whale is not even in the original story, it says a great fish, right? And that's an incredibly small part of the story, right? And so it seems like we teach that, especially to children, like, oh, it has a whale in it, so kids will like it, right? And then we get caught up in that, and as we grow up, we're like, well, God, that couldn't have happened. Like, how can someone survive in the belly of a whale? That's not scientifically possible. And it becomes this sort of almost litmus test or something where it's like either like we believe it because if it says it, if the Bible says it, then this had to happen. If you don't believe it, then you disregard the whole Bible. Or it's like, well, that can't possibly have happened, so we just throw out the whole story. And it's like, why do those have to be the only two options? Because the whale is not the focus of the story. This great fish is not the focus. Like, there's so much more that we learn from this story. And so so I'll just kind of point that out. Like, I intentionally, I don't want to say didn't waste my time on it, but kind of didn't waste my time on it because I really hope we understood that, like, that's not the point of the story. It's, like, whether or not a whale could swallow a guy and he could live for 3 days. Like, because it's like, well, yeah, I mean, if God wanted to do that, then I believe God could do that. Did it have to happen? Whatever. You know, I hope I don't get pushback for that, but it's like the story is trying to tell us a point. Mm-hmm. And I mean, Jesus referenced the way. He himself referenced the story.
Yeah.
So again, like, Jesus obviously believed that there was truth and there was power in that story and something that he wanted us to look back on and realize that what God did for Jonah, like, Jesus was going to do in an even greater sense. Like, that's, again, the power and the prophecy. So I'll maybe just mention that as to why I sort of didn't even go there.
I love it. And what I love about one of the things that you said was that, you know, why does it have to be he was either in the well or he wasn't in the well? And just a different way of looking at the stories and how can we get to a place to where we don't, it doesn't have to be this or that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that we can dig deeper and be open to the idea that it,
the story is true.
Yes.
And the story still speaks to us and challenges us. Right. Like, period.
Period. Mic drop. Boom. There you go. Today's Q&R is almost over. But first, I have to thank Joel Christian, who is behind the camera and probably messaging you all or saying, hey, I'm here.
Because we'd like to thank our sponsors.
I've been off my game about this for the past couple of weeks. Lou's not here. But Joel is, and so we just want to thank Joel, and I hope that you told him that you were here. I maybe assume I see him over there doing something. So, anyway, and we're so glad that you all were here. Beth, thank you for coming. Yes, Beth, we're so glad you were here. Scott, we are so glad that you could join us again today. Wayne, thank you for being here with us today. Next week, thank you for letting me. Next week, Pastor Adam will be here, I think. Pastor Wayne will be here, and I know that we'll have Pastor Cam from Faith back with us next week. This Sunday, we will all be hearing about Nehemiah. So we will be maybe recapping that next week. If you have questions from Sunday, you can put those on your communication sheets, drop them in the offering. You can email us at questions@broadwayunited.org, and we will talk about those next week right here, Wednesday at noon. So we hope you have a fantastic week. Bye.